Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program was brought to you by 100 Bogart Street, the brand new co-working space in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Learn more at 100bogart.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Good afternoon, and welcome to Eating Matters, where we talk about food policy and how it impacts all of us. I'm your host, Jenna Liute, and we're broadcasting from Roberta's on Heritage Radio Network. Ever wonder what the future holds? Well, today I'm going to tell you. At the start-ish of every winter season, I love talking with those who have their ear to the ground, covering the most important food and ag stories that we expect to be on the forefront of the months ahead. This year, the Food and Environment Reporting Network recently published a new annual survey highlighting the top 10 issues they think will make up the news in 2018. And from the fight to control seed technology to antibiotic resistance in livestock to the health risks of Roundup, not to mention the Farm Bill renewal, there'll be no shortage of things for us to discuss. Joining me on the line today to comment on and further analyze these stories is Sam Fromarts, Editor-in-Chief of the Food and Environment Reporting Network, an independent nonprofit and news organization reporting on food, agriculture, and environmental health through partnerships with regional and national media outlets. Sam, welcome back to the show.
Well, thanks for having me.
Okay, so can you tell me a little bit about this survey? Is this the first year that it was published, or have you done this before?
This was the first year it was published, and I guess it's something that it is editors were always thinking about, but we decided to share our thinking with the public this year. So it was kind of a fun exercise.
Yeah. It was such a fun, engaging read for me. So how did you decide who participated? Is this just, you know, every contributor or your main contributors? What was the decision process like?
Yeah. So we put out a call to our writers, and these are writers who are regularly covering issues for us. And, you know, we asked them what's brewing on the horizon. And this is the list of 10 topics is what they came back to us with. So we had a couple more that, you know, we wanted to make it an even 10. So, you know, we left it at that. You know, some were kind of obvious because, say, the Farm Bill is, you know, a process that happens every 5 years or so that reauthorizes spending on SNAP benefits, which is, you know, what food stamps are now called, mm-hmm. or, you know, as well as subsidies for farmers. And that is going through reauthorization again this year. So that was obvious
going to
be in the news,
yeah,
and a hot topic. So that was an obvious one, and then others that were maybe less obvious, like the brewing battle over seeds, that kind of thing. So, you know, these are just issues that our writers who are covering these topics are, have in their wheelhouse to follow, and they, you know, we asked them to write up just a short little blurb for us to explain what the issue was.
And anything that they kind of came back with. So, I mean, I'm assuming there was some sort of consensus on these issues. Like, did a lot of the reporters kind of say the same stuff, and that's how you, one of the ways you made the decision?
Not really, because they're covering such varied areas, mm-hmm. like Maren McKenna, for example, who covers antibiotics and livestock. She has actually a wonderful book out on the subject called Big Chicken, but mm-hmm. she's really right in the mix of these issues and knowing what the latest developments are. So, you know, she sort of versed us in that one. And so all these writers really have various specialties. Another example of the Farm Bill, again, is written up by Chuck Abbott, who does our daily policy coverage from mm-hmm. Washington. So he's really in the thick of the blow by blow.
Yeah, we've had Chuck on a couple of times. He's great.
Yeah, yeah. So he's really in the thick of it. But
we asked
him for this little thing to just step back a little bit and, you know, tell us what's going on.
Anything that surprised you that you didn't see coming?
Well, I guess some things that were quite. I guess I wasn't aware, for example, that the Mangus-Stevens Act, which deals with fisheries and deals with how the country regulates its fisheries, I wasn't aware that that's up for reauthorization again.
Mm-hmm.
That was a little bit of a surprise because the U.S. fisheries are actually in pretty good shape. But if this bill is, you know, emaciated, if it's taken down, that could put that in threat again, the fisheries in threat again. And others like Elizabeth Reut's little blurb on food waste, that may be a little bit of a narrow one, but sort of like what's the next step in dealing with food waste, that was new to me.
Mm-hmm.
And then just what Paige wrote, Paige Embry wrote on bees and pollinators, because you know, bees and pollinators are obviously have been in the news for quite a while, but what's potentially going on in the next year, and what she tied it to was the whole decline in research funding at government bodies that actually research issues like pollinators.
Mm-hmm.
And with the budget cuts that are being proposed and being worked through, that's the type of research that'll get the axe. And so, you know, for a issue like pollinators that's on the, you know, really on the front burner, and they're so crucial to our food production, by helping pollination, you know, that could be a threat down the road.
Right, absolutely. Let's start there and jump into that topic a little bit more. So when we think about kind of the declining bee population, which we've covered a little bit on the show, you know, I personally think of things like the culprits being industrial agriculture, pathogens, climate change, the loss of biodiversity, kind of all of these issues. And it was interesting to me because she kind of talked a little bit about something different that I hadn't really heard a lot about, which was the absconding of bees. So they're kind of just like flying away, and that kind of leading to the declining population, and scientists don't know why. So can you give us a little bit more background on this topic?
Well, I mean, it ties into just, you know, all the things that you mentioned, which is all the various threats that bees face. And I think what she was pointing to was that, you know, research was going in to this one aspect of it, which was, you know, dealing with a chemical attractant to bring the bees, you know, to where they're supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say, you know, just on other things that Paige has written and other things that we've written at Fern, I mean, there's a lot of research going on about bees and the whole issue of colony collapse disorder, where, you know, somewhere on the order of a range of, you know, a third of all bee colonies die, you know, every winter, and all the various reasons for that going on. And it's so complicated, and, you know, inevitably the agrochemical industry wants to point to pathogens, and environmentalists want to point to the agrochemical industry with their pesticides. And, you know, it seems like all of these various things are really interacting, and the science is quite complicated. But I think the point that Paige is making is, you know, if you don't spend money figuring it out, I mean, that's going to be a huge loss.
And then what agency is responsible for that?
USDA does some of that research. I mean, it happens in other bodies as well, like the National Science Foundation. But a lot of those grants flow through universities, and, you know, it just isn't, you know, if that support is cut, and it's already tenuous, if you talk to most, you know, researchers, that'll mean that, you know, these experiments can't occur, so solutions can't be found.
So we touched on for a second food waste, and in this kind of overview, Elizabeth writes that food scrap recovery in the U.S. has increased by 87%, which is quite remarkable. So, what's the issue here? What's wrong?
Well, yeah, the issue here is we waste like 40% of our food. So.
Right. Still, okay.
You know, that's the issue. And it's great that cities and municipalities are undertaking composting programs, but, you know, wouldn't it be great too if we actually wasted less than than we did. But what she's finding is this sort of next generation. I would call it next generation composting, but it's probably not the accurate term because it's how you know, cities will begin to institute these anaerobic digesters that generate both biogas, which is, you know, fuel, and as well as heat. So, and actually, I'm in Washington D.C. and Washington D.C. our sewage treatment facility. It's not a food composting operation, but it is a biosolid where it's digested, so to speak, and it produces energy to fuel the plant as well as, a biosolid product that can be used as compost. Although in the organic world, at least, it's pretty controversial about whether you should use something like that.
But what's the issue here, though? I mean, just in general for these anaerobic digesters.
The issue is that they're pretty expensive.
Mm-hmm.
So I think to make it worthwhile, you really need a pretty vast system of waste collection. And but once you have that, the investment in these plants can pay off. But it's really kind of the latest, newest wave that's going on.
Who owns these? Are these like a state-owned, city-owned kind of, not technology, but plant. Yes, yes.
On one end,
infrastructure.
You get the product on the other end. I think some of them are state-owned, they're municipal-owned, and then I think I would have to check, but I think some are private as well. So.
Okay. Interesting.
But she points out that the number of these plants is expected to jump as more food waste is collected, as landfills get, you know, fuller, and, as cities adopt zero waste goals. So
speaking of food waste, on the opposite end of that, Lisa Hamilton writes about battles over seed technologies and how that can affect our food source moving forward, or, you know, how it's like responding to natural disasters that put our food source in jeopardy, and how if we don't have this technology, it could really put our food source in jeopardy moving forward. So can you tell us a little bit more about this kind of debate and what's at stake?
Yeah, and if you want to really get into that debate, just Google Lisa Hamilton.
Mm-hmm.
She's done a lot of really great articles on this subject. having to do with, you know, who controls seed, the kind of battles over it, and as well as things like open source seed, where seed is freely shared and no one controls its intellectual property.
Mm-hmm.
So what she's talking about is it's pretty well recognized that, you know, we're going to face new stresses going forward, especially with climate change. And so seed researchers are trying to breed new types of seed that are more resilient for the new era, you know, that's coming. And the question is, who controls that seed? And whether that's the appropriate response, or say locally adapted varieties that have been, you know, developed by farmers over millennium by saving and selecting, you know, seeds that they like, whether that's kind of the more appropriate way forward.
Can that not happen now?
And you see a sort of a combination of both of those. And actually the most interesting stuff is happening when this either collect those traditional seeds, which are known as Wanray seeds, as well as wild cultivars. That's like seeds that just grow in the wild that have never been domesticated,
mm-hmm.
and using elements of their genetics in seed breeding because they may have novel disease resistance or novel response to drought or whatever it is. So it's a fairly technical area, but it's also highly politicized because
Does it have to do with GMOs?
Countries that have these seeds, they don't want it essentially to be ripped off and have their, you know, seed technology privatized.
So I guess what are we talking about when we talk about seed technology? Primarily, will this primarily affect commodity crops, or is this like the, you know, the specialty fruits and vegetable crops that we're talking about?
It's definitely going on in more commodity crops, but it's going on in things like quinoa. You know, it could be in different types of sweet potatoes or cassava, which are, you know, staple plants in, you know, other parts of the world. So, you know, it's a range of things. And probably less so in the sort of corn, soybean, which is really controlled by the major agrochemical companies, you know, these days, and they have, you know, a lock hold on that technology.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, where you might see it in corn is maybe in Mexico, with where there are battles over protecting their native corn varieties, for example. So that genetically modified corn, you know, doesn't cross with those plants and end them forever.
Mm-hmm.
So Mexico, for example, still bans GMO mm-hmm. corn.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's talk about some agrochemical companies and what issues that we expect to face from them in the next year. And it seems like this is, you know, a couple opportunities. The first being Monsanto with the Roundup kind of debate and whether or not glyphosate is, you know, the extent to which it is hazardous to our health. Can you give us a little bit of background on this?
Yeah, it's a really interesting controversy because one body, an agency of the World Health Organization, deemed that that Roundup or glyphosate, which is the active ingredient in the herbicide Roundup, they determined that it was linked to cancer. Now, that sort of propelled a whole range of lawsuits in the United States, even though, you know, many other bodies, including the EPA and European, you know, authorities, deemed that it was not a carcinogen.
Right.
So But I guess what we're watching is sort of how these suits are going to unfold in this country, and there's a major action in California with them, and then California also required a cancer warning on the glyphosate on Roundup, the label of Roundup. And, you know, this is quite significant because it's the most widely used herbicide in the world. So it's really quite prevalent. And Monsanto, of course, you know, says this is all unfounded, you know, and is fighting back. And we did a long story on this that sort of that looked into the ways that Monsanto is fighting back and the way it uses researchers and science to kind of sway the battle in their favor.
Right.
So if anyone's interested in that background, I would direct them to that story on our site. But that's going to continue to brew. That issue is not over by any means. So we'll expect to see more on that, you know, down the road.
Yeah. And then, you know, I kind of, speaking of large companies trying to sway the science or at least public opinion in their favor, you expect to see some, you know, the battle over kind of like nutrition and, you know, nutritional spin, really, nutritional science and spin heat up this year as well, according to Eliza.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen a lot of pretty interesting articles, investigations, scholarly exposés in scientific journals about the way, for example, the sugar industry had quashed, you know, science that was, you know, critical of their, you know, of sugar.
Mm-hmm.
And that goes, you know, that dates all the way back to the 60s. And there was a lot of, you know, there were a lot of really interesting revelations about that that came out in the past year. Liza Gross, who wrote that little piece for us, in following a lot of these issues and is a prolific science writer, she, you know, she senses that more is going to come on this issue, you know, in the coming year.
And is it going to be?
And you've even seen it with, you know, various in the past, not in the past year, but in the recent past about, you know, Coca-Cola funding researchers, you know, et cetera, to sort of, you know, shift the blame away from sugary drinks' role in obesity to, you know, more. You know, it's lack of exercise, it's
right.
not diet, that kind of thing.
Right.
So, you know, so she expects that more will be coming on this. And she's done actually some really interesting work on, she did a sort of an expose about one science group for us that funds, facilitates a lot of communication between scientific authorities and journalists, and she was saying that that group was sort of spinning science in a particular industry-friendly way. So that was one thing she did for us, and she's done other work, most recently, not for us, but interesting work on the risk of e-cigarettes, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So she's pretty, in terms of the sort of conflict of interest in science and spinning science, she's kind of a leading writer on that issue.
Great. Okay, well, we're going to take a really quick commercial break and hear a word from our sponsors. But when we get back, we're going to continue our conversation with Sam Vromerts about what reporters at the Food and Environment Reporting Network think are going to be the hot topics of 2018. Stay tuned.
Bogart Street is finally open and ready for Bushwick. 100 Bogart is a brand new, state-of-the-art co-working space that provides turnkey workspaces, including open layout desks, meeting spaces, and furnished private offices. Members have access to top-notch amenities such as custom furniture, high-speed internet, spacious kitchenettes with coffee and tea, printers, scanners, and much more. Alongside their professional work environment, 100 Bogart also provides exclusive educational programming for any curious entrepreneur. Heritage Radio Network has made their new office home at 100 Bogart and will host many events there in the future. For more information about their co-working space, visit 100bogart.com and become a member to network, create, and educate.
And we're back on Eating Matters, where today I'm speaking with Sam Frommaerts, Editor-in-Chief of the Food and Environment Reporting Network, about what his writers think are the key issues that will drive food and ag coverage for this year. Okay, so we have a few more. We've got about three more topics to cover that you guys think are going to be kind of the biggest and baddest topics of 2018. And I want to kind of jump off the post-break discussion with something that we touched on earlier, which is the American fisheries being in the deregulation crosshairs. And this starts with the Magnuson-Stevens Act, which is up for, or can you just give us a little bit of an overview about what's happening with the act right now and why this is such a timely issue?
Yeah, because the Magnuson-Stevens Act, it was first passed in 1976, and it limited foreign vessels from fishing in American waters.
Mm-hmm.
And it also really put in a series of regulations that protected fisheries. By most accounts, I mean, the U.S. fisheries are either coming back or they're in a pretty healthy state.
So prevented overfishing.
Preventing overfishing. For example, in West Coast fisheries that were long red-listed by the Monterey Bay Aquarium Seafood Watch. That's the you might see those at retailers or, wallet cards where they give a red for something to avoid and green for something to, it's okay that it's sustainable. So West Coast fisheries for a long time, many of them were on the red list, and they've recently switched over to either yellow or green, which is a better or a good alternative. So those conservation measures have worked, but now, it's interesting with the Trump administration. There've been a number of measures to open up either public lands or public fisheries to be more industry friendly.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the question here is whether the restrictions on fishing will be reduced to allow more fishing, and whether that will cause sort of these fisheries to be overfished.
So conservation
groups have called this whole effort to sort of emasculate the Magnuson-Stevens Act. They're calling it the Empty Oceans Act.
And why are we talking about this now? Is it's up for reauthorization or?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And is this something that has to do with the Farm Bill, or is this separate from?
No, this is separate. So this was put forward by a Republican from Alaska who wants to overhaul the act, and it's passed the House Committee on Natural Resources. And it'll likely go to the floor sometime this year, but hopefully it won't get the. It'll be one of those measures that dies, because this. I mean, by any measure, this act, in place in '76 has been, quite successful in bringing our fisheries back. And the other point about that is, it's not that it's a meeting on industry, we're not going to allow any fishing, because if you talk to fishermen, once the fisheries come back and the fishery is better managed, it ensures they'll have fish to catch in the future.
Mm-hmm.
And some fisheries you know, gets so decimated that there's no fish left, and then, you know, boats go bankrupt and,
right.
and the whole fishery completely collapses. So nobody wants that either. So it's like, what's the middle ground that allows for a sustainable level of fishing?
And there has been, I mean, like, why now change it, right? So I think that, is this just because we have, like, a particularly deregulation-oriented Congress and just administration, or is this something that has been kind of brewing for a while?
Well, I think it's a combination of that and also, you know, those in Congress who want, you know, who want to redo this, and, you know, whether they're pushed by fishing interests or whoever, you know, they're going to try and make it happen. So it really parallels what's happening, you know, in the public lands debate too, which
yeah.
is, you know, selling off more land for oil and gas drilling, open up more areas again, you know, that kind of thing.
Well, so let's talk about public lands. What are these kind of, I mean, they're public lands by definition, but kind of who regulates these and what is entailed to designate something a public land or not?
Well, I mean, I think the most interesting thing here is sort of the high-profile battle over the monuments that Obama, you know, designated at the end of his administration, and specifically the Bears Ears National mm-hmm. Monument in Utah,
mm-hmm.
And put it, you know, created a national monument that would really keep it in its natural state and prevent industry from going in. And that's precisely what Secretary Zinke, you know, and Trump said they were going to try and redo, and, you know, they have. I mean, they're going to face lawsuits over it, but,
right.
you know, they want to roll back those areas, you know, as well as others. And it's a big, you know, it's a big battle in the West, and there's a whole very vocal libertarian movement to sort of take lands out of federal hands and put them, you know, into states' rights, or allow ranchers to use them. And, you know, the most vocal proponent of that has been the Bundy family, you know, which has been tried and
yeah.
acquitted on a couple of occasions.
So can you give us
the ones behind the armed standoff with federal officials.
Yeah. And that is something I feel like I knew that was happening, but I didn't really pay, I mean, full disclosure, like that,
yeah,
that
yeah.
much
well,
attention to it.
But because it's a public lands issue and you don't really think of it as a food issue, but it does. A lot of these public lands involve issues of ranching, and because cattle graze on them.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the portion of ranchers that want some sort of, you know, that want these so-called freedoms, they're not entirely supported, because there's an argument that grazing costs would go up dramatically if they were under state control, because it takes a lot of money to sort of, you know, to manage these lands.
Mm-hmm.
And right now they're leased at a very low, you know, undercost rate to ranchers. And if the cost reflected what it actually costs, you know, authorities to manage these lands, then the cost to ranchers would be much higher. So there's a whole group that's worried that, you know, if these do go back to states, it could lead to higher grazing fees, for example.
Right.
But what the Bundys did was, you know, basically just seize the land for their own control.
They just took it.
Yeah,
yeah,
exactly. And they haven't been,
apprehended.
Yeah, they've been charged, but they've gotten off. And my understanding is, I think they're still grazing those lands. I may be wrong on that, but
yeah.
You know, so it's a, you know, these Western lands, there's a lot of federal land, so it's a pretty controversial issue. But I think both of these, you know, the fisheries issue and this, it's sort of, you know, the question of what do you do with the commons, and how do you regulate it, and who has access to it,
mm-hmm.
who has control over it, and who can make money off of it.
Right.
And those are The really interesting thing about this is that on the other side of the issue are not only conservationists and environmentalists, which you would expect, but also a pretty vocal group of hunters and outdoor enthusiasts who use the lands as well and want access to them, and maybe not, you know, don't want, you know, oil drilled in,
right,
you know, in these areas so that they can continue to use them.
Right.
And the hunters, at least, especially, tend to be a pretty conservative, you know, Republican leaning group.
Yeah.
So it sort of makes for an interesting split there.
Yeah, absolutely. Anything that we, you know, why is this timely right now, or why do we expect to see more of this in the next year?
Well, simply because the Trump administration is trying to undo, you know, and open up a lot of these lands to oil and gas drilling, you know, to reduce regulations of them, you know, that kind of thing.
I mean, why, I guess I don't understand why this would be something that even Bundy would be supportive of. I mean, I guess, you know, he just went ahead and seized public land, but it just seems like it would be a conflict of interest for anybody who benefits off of using that land, including the ranchers who might rely on utilizing it to subsidize their costs.
Yeah, I mean, they obviously need access to the land, and the question is, which land should it be, you know, and how much you should pay, how much should you pay for it, and who should be in control of those decisions?
Mm-hmm.
If it's just a rancher saying, you know, I just want this land because it's nearby, you know, I don't think that, you know, it's essentially me deciding, you know, the public park 2 blocks from my house is, you know, I really want to use that for my own use, and I'm just going to do it.
Right.
So I don't think that would be allowed.
Yeah.
But in this case, it's public lands in the West, and it's a whole different issue.
Well, interesting. Definitely, I look forward to kind of seeing what unfolds with that. Yeah.
I think there'll be more fireworks on that this year for sure.
So then, kind of lastly, I want to touch on ag consolidation, which is something, just consolidation in general, I've been very fascinated with, and we've no doubt seen a lot of, at least over the past year or so. So can you kind of touch on a couple of the big mergers from 2017 and what is coming down the pike in 2018?
Well, I think what you've seen is just a consolidation of these huge agrochemical companies. And essentially, they're all involved in mergers, and you know, I think that's gonna. I don't know that that's gonna continue. Essentially, because that process is sort of winding up. But the impact of that, I think, is more interesting, which is, and it's something that farmers, to a degree, some farmers are worried about. Which is, you put power in, you know, the control of, you know,
a few,
just a very few, you know, handful of companies. You know, where does that leave them?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and that has to do with monopoly control of seeds or chemicals or, you know, all these things that farmers are dependent on. And, you know, could potentially raise their costs.
Also, it, you know, with this whole Amazon acquisition of Whole Foods, I would imagine that farmers might be worried that, you know, I mean, Amazon kind of is notorious for coming in and being able to lower prices on certain items, or, you know, at least that's the perception that they give. And certainly it is true for a few items. And the question that I think that raises is what happens on the, you know, who absorbs those costs? And it seems to me that farmers are going to be, in all likelihood, the ones who do so.
Reports on that we've had in our daily policy briefing of, you know, people, suppliers complaining now about that at Whole Foods, and sort of openly talking about, you know, what's happened since that acquisition.
Yeah.
I think it fits into this whole trend of, you know, of very few companies controlling vast amounts of businesses and revenue. And where does that leave
right.
the rest of us? So I think you're starting to see also in the political sphere some of that backlash against consolidation. Mm-hmm. And you have politicians, especially in sort of the Democratic or more left wing of the Democratic Party, you know, raising these issues on a national scale.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's going to continue. I mean, it'd be interesting to see how that crops up in the fall elections, if it does at all.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly in the next presidential campaign in 2020.
Absolutely. Okay, so I there was one more. I hate to go 9 out of 10 issues and forget the 10th, and this is such a huge issue across the board, and it is antibiotic resistance in livestock. So this seems to be like something that is, you know, we've been talking about for a long time, although not a lot has necessarily been done on it, or not enough, a lot of people would say. But, you know, can I tell us about kind of what we can expect to see in 2018, especially a year after some headway has been made to limit the amount of routine use of antibiotics?
Right. So that was the significant thing that the FDA did, was they instituted these measures to limit antibiotics, and there were also voluntary measures by the industry itself. And I think the question now is, as some livestock producers cut back on antibiotics, what's the impact? Is antibiotic use actually going down?
Mm-hmm.
And for the first time, the FDA is releasing numbers on actual antibiotic use, which hasn't been the case previously. So we're starting to see, you know, so this year will be a good indication of how these voluntary measures, as well as some of the, you know, the regulated measures that the FDA took, what impact they're having, if anything. But yeah, it's a huge issue. It's still recognized as a major public health issue by
everybody,
public health,
yeah
body around, and you know, and others are further ahead. Mostly European nations in terms of getting these antibiotics out of the animal production routine.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, hopefully there's kind of good. The findings will be positive after this first year, or if not, we'll be able to kind of do some further regulating. Because
yeah, I mean, the interesting thing is And, you know, you can't just give the antibiotics as a prophylactic, you know, in their daily feed, but you can get approval from a veterinarian to use the antibiotics in the case of sickness. And the question is whether that use in sickness is going to be a loophole that allows essentially the same kind of feeding of antibiotics to animals to continue. So I think that's the question that Maren was raising in that little piece.
Well, definitely more to come on that. And we will certainly be covering it in greater detail as the months unfold. Well, I think that's all we have time for today. Sam, I want to thank you so very much for coming on the show.
Okay. Well, thanks for having me. It's great talking to you.
Absolutely. You too.
Okay.
To read more about these issues and all of the amazing coverage from The Fern, go to thefern.org. I want to give a big thanks to our sponsors for their generous support, and thank you, as always, to our fabulous engineer, Vitor Hirscht. Show music is by Tim Archer. All episodes of Eating Matters are available on the Heritage Radio Network website or as a podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. If you haven't done so already, please subscribe and leave me a comment. Let me know what you think. I'm Jenna Liute, and thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Ever wonder what kind of podcast Julia Child would have made? Probably would have been one where she introduced you to all of her latest discoveries and favorite people. And that's exactly the tradition we're following on Inside Julia's Kitchen, the podcast of the Julia Child Foundation for Gastronomy and the Culinary Arts. Join me, Todd Shulkin, your host, and the Foundation's Executive Director, as I bring you inside the Foundation's world to meet the bright lights of today's food universe, just as Julia used to do from her own famous kitchen. New episodes air on Heritage Radio Network, Wednesdays at noon Eastern. Listen in.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.